Welcome to the Vortex Nation podcast, brought to you by lovers of hunting, shooting, public lands, the Second Amendment, and good food.
What is going on, everybody? I've got Jim to my right, frequent guest, Eric Barber, across the table, and a guy that we hope you never have to call, but thank goodness you can call him. We've got Tim Kill from Deer Recovery Blood Tracking with us today to talk all about everything about blood tracking dogs and the process and everything goes into it. And it's a really perfect timing right now because, speaking of dogs, I was out letting our new dog out this morning. We're kind of mid, late July-ish. Fall is in the air. You can smell the change. Yep. Look at Jim. There's the chills. Oh, there they are. I'm getting excited.
They're on a hair trigger. I tell you, it doesn't take much.
It really doesn't take much. I'm easily excited. Fall's in the air, everybody, and that means hunting seasons are about to start.
Are you training up that new dog of yours to do some tracking? Is that the idea?
Well,
we should let the
I'm
going
to get to that. I'm going to get to that question.
We should let the people know what kind of dog you have now.
So we have a new family dog. Our first dog, it's a Cavalier King Charles. I keep saying we're going to try and turn it into the world's smallest sporting dog.
It'll be great. You can just have it hop right out of the purse and then hopefully go
recover your rabbit.
Yeah,
it's a satchel. it's got some spaniel in it. Or I think they are a spaniel. I think they're a type of spaniel.
Yeah, something like that.
Cute as the Dickens. I think it's going to be probably about like maybe 19 pounds-ish. Oof. So kind of like a smedium, I guess.
Yeah.
But I plan, that's one of my questions that I have slated for Tim here. So,
absolutely.
Tim, before we ramble on for hours, please introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about you and what you have going on, and then we'll jump right in.
Sure. Cool. Well, I appreciate the opportunity to share this moment with you guys. I am out of North Madison area, and my dog is 6 years old now, and I've been tracking for about three or four years. Every year has been more and more. I didn't start tracking. I have just taken it up in the last 3 years predominantly.
Yeah, okay.
So,
Gotcha.
Did you take it up because of, did you get a dog that was like really good at it and then you wanted to do it because the dog really liked doing it? Or did you do it because you wanted to do it and then you found a dog that was the perfect candidate for it?
Sure. That's a good question. The dog I have is one of the versatile breeds, and our focus was on birds and waterfowl hunting for the first couple years of her life. And then I had a couple of experiences, like a lot of deer hunters will, of a deer that you thought for sure was just over the next hill or around the next bend and just weren't there. And that kind of weighs on the back of your mind. You don't forget those when they happen to you. And so I decided to pursue this with the dog a bit further and found that she, my dog, really enjoys the work. So It's become our fall passion now.
That's awesome.
What what breed is your dog then?
My breed is a poodle pointer.
Oh, no kidding.
It's, if you're familiar with the German wire hairs or the Griffons, it's similar to that. It's got a lot of the feathering and furnishings of those European hunting dogs.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, they don't really necessarily look, if you envision a poodle, P-O-O-D-L-E, don't they even spell it differently, the poodle part?
Correct.
If you envision that, it's not exactly quite the same.
No, it's not at all the same.
Right.
It's it was originally the German Wasser poodle, which that reference to poodle is toward puddle dog.
Okay.
Oh,
interesting.
Okay.
Got it.
So it's a water pointing dog.
Yeah,
that's cool.
I mean, they have webbed feet, right?
Yep.
Like, kind of like similar to a lab, but then they're also really great upland dogs.
Yep.
No, like my cousin.
Yeah. Oh, man.
It's not true. It's
your
not
poodle
true,
cousin.
Very cool. This is one thing that I was curious about. So we kind of just touched on it. What breeds do make a good blood tracking dog? Can it be any dog, or are there specific ones, or like a, you know, like ones kind of like yours that are maybe bred or have a tendency to be like a sporting dog, a duck dog, a bird dog? Is that, or are those the types of dogs that become blood tracking dogs, or can it be other types as well?
Sure. That's a good question. There are a great deal of trackers out there that have dog breeds that are dedicated to big game tracking work.
Okay.
And they specialize in that, but there are a lot of more versatile type dogs that have other interests throughout the year, and those are common as well. And they're both good. Some are specialists, such as bloodhounds and Bavarian mountain hounds and so forth. They specialize in tracking work, and so they're dedicated specifically to that. I chose not to go that route because of my other interests in the rest of the year and so forth.
Right.
So there's the Catahoulas, the Lacys are good, Beagles are good, Labs, German Shorthair, some of those type of breeds. German Wirehairs are common as well, Drahtars.
Sure. So.
And we were talking about the name of your business before we started here. Deer Recovery Blood Tracking, okay? And you immediately said, you're like, well, there's some misnomers in there, like right off the go. Yep. So maybe let's speak to, like, actually what's going on when you are blood tracking.
Sure. So the process of tracking with a dog is bringing in a dog to the, preferably to the hit site. A lot of hunters will prefer to go to their last blood. But as a tracker, our preference would generally be to go to the hit site and follow that to the last blood. It does a couple of things. It gives the handler and the dog a period to assess that track, the value of that track. And it also enables the dog to lock onto that specific track. So if the deer discontinues bleeding or losing body fluids, the dog is anchored to that specific interdigital scent, perhaps, or body scent.
Okay.
Just in case there's raccoons or other deer that have crossed that track since that track was established there. So then we get to that track. We follow that. It also gives us, as a handler, a chance to evaluate what the hunter believes happened versus what we are seeing with the track as well. And it's not a reflection of the type of hunter.
Yep.
That adrenaline just runs high.
Absolutely.
And it's easy to misinterpret what happens after the shot is taken, for sure.
Yep. And it happens so fast. I think that was the big thing. When I used to film deer hunts, one of the big things that I'd notice and learn from that experience was what you would see and what you perceived happened, actually, when you would, slow that footage down frame by frame, was entirely different than what actually happened. You got deer turning, and I know, that's one thing we'll get into, deer that are on really high alert body positions and what that does to the skeletal and musculature structure of the animal and how that impacts wounds, all that stuff. I know we'll get into that for sure, and that's fascinating information. But I think that's kind of a good starting point right there is like, How different that can be perceived from the hunter in regards to what actually did happen.
Well, plus, Eric, I think, too, we're so excited to talk about, like, so many things regarding this, especially because it does involve, like, this super high adrenaline exciting moment and then recovering the thing that you've spent so much time and energy and all that trying to hunt. You actually, the reason we know Tim or that we got a hold of Tim is because you ended up using his services at one point.
Yep.
And I think that some people, because at this point in time, especially right now in history, we have a lot more people getting into hunting than ever before.
Yep.
I remember when, even myself getting first into it, I remember thinking when people would first explain, well, you shoot and then, for example, you don't shoot the deer and immediately start crawling out of your tree stand and trying to run after it, right?
Yep.
So a lot of people will wait, a period of time before they actually even make any moves. And that was super weird as a new hunter to hear because I just always thought you hit them, they just drop dead.
Boom,
right there, you know. But that doesn't actually happen. Many times that doesn't even happen, even if you had a really good shot. Then you throw in the mixture of you're not always going to have a perfect shot. We're all human beings. We're going to make mistakes now and then, even if you are a really good hunter.
Yep.
And so, there are times where, they'll get the chance and they have a huge adrenaline rush, which we all know what adrenaline can do. It doesn't matter if it's a human being or another animal. They have an adrenaline rush. They're probably not going to just fold, although it maybe has happened. Probably not necessarily just going to fold right where you shot them.
Absolutely. So. And I think that's a good kind of starting point. So we can talk about, there. We have, you know, we're looking at the spreadsheet of all your recoveries from, or track jobs from last year. And so myself and a really good friend of mine are number one and two on the list.
Number one.
And,
top two, baby.
Yep. And so what's interesting about that is I think we can kind of preface both of those situations. And in my opinion, and I'll let you weigh in on this too, Tim, but I think I did a lot of things wrong. We got very lucky that, you know, we ended up being able to recover that deer, whereas my buddy did everything right, which really ultimately helped you and the dog recover his buck. So just to kind of preface that a little bit, the deer that you helped me recover was on opening day. Temperatures were very, very warm that day and the following, which was the day that we ended up recovering the deer. It was a liver hit deer, I believe, kind of a further back shot. And where we went wrong is, you know, shot the deer, and everything that I perceived at that moment, I thought I was doing the right thing. I left the arrow sit out in the field overnight. I went back in at midnight. I knew it was roughly liver-ish where the arrow impacted the deer, just from replaying that moment in my mind. And I gave it about 7 hours, so around 1 a.m. I snuck back out, looked at the arrow in the field, confirmed it was liver blood, looked like, you know, that dark telltale liver blood.
So, Eric, you didn't even look at the arrow?
Nope.
Until you went back out?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Because, you know, I think, and what we can touch on that too, like the deer reacted by just kind of hunching up and kind of sauntered off the field edge.
Okay.
And it looked like it was going to bed down very close to the impact site, so I didn't want to spook it. So I snuck out, snuck back in, looked at the arrow, confirmed liver blood, and we tracked him. We actually, myself and three friends, followed that blood trail. And this is where we start going the wrong path. Wrong path by, I mean, what you don't want to do if you have a suspected instance where you're going to want to call a blood tracker or a deer recovery service. And by doing that, we had all that ground scent all over the area. And then where we lost blood, ultimately, we figured for sure this deer had to be dead. Now it's at this point, it's 3:30 in the morning, and we kind of spread out and we did a little miniature grid search. So just thinking of the grid search, the amount of people that I had in there, and what my next steps were after that shot, could you just kind of break down what you would suggest I do differently in that situation?
Sure. So first off, I would say that you did the right thing in marking the hit site,
mm-hmm.
and you waited the appropriate time as mm-hmm. well. For a liver hit deer, 6 to 8, sometimes 12 hours, depending on the deer's reaction, is a good idea for liver hit deer. Mm-hmm. And I also am confident that deer had expired and was at that spot throughout the period of time where you attempted the grid search, because it wasn't that far, if I recall.
65 feet from where I stopped looking for it to where we recovered it the next morning. Mm-hmm. 65 feet.
But it was expired.
Yep.
So you weren't going to see any glowing eye in the
searchlights. It was down in
lights.
The ditch a little bit.
Behind some logs, yeah. So when we got there with the dog, we started at the hit site, and then we got into this really heavy brush, as I recall, and she wanted to go actually in opposite direction, and I believe that she was picking up scent from your grid search effort.
Yep.
And at one point, we kind of circled around, and she got downwind of that buck, and I don't believe she was really on that track very much. But she knew where that deer was, and she took us right to it. It was
instantaneous.
It was a pretty short track.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
When you see a dog get downwind to something, it's almost as though they've physically been hit by something. I mean, because they just shoot their attention right there. I saw that, actually. I was curious because I noticed it said on your description of what happened, it said, Chaco located deer by body scent, not by tracking. And so it's an interesting distinction there that you might just think, well, if you bring a dog out and it finds a deer, it tracked it.
Yep.
But actually, it may not have tracked it because the track may have been so tampered with or difficult to follow. It may have just gotten itself in the right position, and there's that body scent.
Yep, sure.
Yep.
I got a couple things. One thing, Eric, you know, I think that's worth pointing out. Like, you did do a lot of things right.
Yep.
And kind of, I guess, you know, with the circumstances being warmer temps, knowing that you've already left this deer for a few hours,
yep.
you were pretty confident in the type of hit that it was.
Yep.
You did have blood initially.
Yep. Arrow passed through.
Like, I'm not going to say I don't look for that deer that night, too, because the clock is ticking.
Yep.
Like, you know, it's not like it's late November. There's snow on the ground. Like, you know, you're trying to weigh, like, recovering the deer, making those right decisions to not bump the deer,
yep.
and also have the best chance of recovering the meat from that deer as well. So you're kind of in a tricky spot.
Yeah.
You know, a question I had, though, because you guys did walk around, because you did grid search, as Jim said, you kind of tampered with the track, if you will. When that's happening, is that confusing or becomes more difficult for the dog because there's just so many types of scent there? Like, I've got human. Nope, here's a deer. Here's that. Or is a person potentially, and maybe the answer is both, I don't know, potentially, like, crossing that track and then taking the deer's scent with your boots and then leading the dog astray?
Yep. Yeah, so I like to share a visualization of this. If you go to, let's say, a soccer field early in the morning after a heavy dew,
okay.
and the grass yep. kind of has a silver shine to it, and you go to the edge of that with a couple of buddies, and one of them is instructed to walk out there, meander about, maybe do a circle, and walk out the side. You can see that track from your starting position.
Yep.
And that can be what it's like for a dog on a track, that it's that clear cut, just follow that scent trail. But instead of doing that, you bring in a couple other buddies, and they cross that track a couple times, they get on their knees, they crawl through it, they intercept it, and they double back on it, maybe, and so on and so forth. And then they leave the field in a different direction. And then you bring in somebody that didn't witness any of this tracking, and you ask them to get on that original track, stay on that original track only, and follow it exactly the way it went through there. It's a challenge and perhaps impossible mm-hmm. to do
okay.
for that reason. Hmm. So when you bring in a grid search effort, you essentially contaminate that track for the dog. You cross it, you leave your own body scent there, you pick up there. That track, which sometimes may not be blood, it might be minute body particles and scent from their breath and from their nose and dander from the deer and so on and so forth. And that gets spread about in directions opposite of the route that the deer actually took. So
yep.
our preference as a tracker is, I understand as a hunter why it goes that way, but we would suggest not considering a tracking dog a last resort. Consider grid search a last resort. Bring in a tracking dog prior, because if you do them in the opposite order, it is nearly impossible, or you certainly reduce the likelihood of success, at
yep.
least where that grid okay. search was taken. Sometimes you can take a dog around that and bypass the contaminated area and reacquire the track.
Mm-hmm.
That's not always easy to do, but yep. it does happen.
I think that is the biggest takeaway from this
yep.
entire conversation, is make your grid search your last resort, not your first.
Yep.
You know, you're going to do more harm than good. If you did have a chance, now you've just contaminated the area. You can always do that retroactively, but you can always, on the other hand, call in a tracking dog as a proactive solution.
Yep. Yeah. At the first moment that in your mind, as you're on this track, you start thinking, I may not find this deer. That's an ideal time to
yep.
pull out your phone and make some calls. If a dog is not available within the time frame that you are hoping for or need for your schedule, you can always do a grid search, but you can't always do a grid search and then bring in a dog
sure.
again after that fact.
Mm-hmm.
Eric, when you called in,
yep.
first off, how did you find, so for somebody out there
yeah.
who's like, you know, how did you find Tim? And then I remember you saying that when you called Tim, some of the questions that Tim was going through with you to sort of assess the situation
yep.
beforehand, I remember your description, where you're like, I wouldn't have thought to think of any of these things.
Yep,
but
exactly.
anyway, how did you find him first?
So I looked up, unitedbloodtrackers.org. It's a website that I was familiar of as a really good resource, like across the United States, not even just in Wisconsin. And you can, like, on that, you can plug in your zip code and you can find trackers in your area within a certain mile radius. So there is that's how I found your information.
Sure.
And it was like 5 a.m. that day that I was like, normally I don't like to text people, especially people I don't know, that early in the morning. But I was prefacing everything. Hey, I apologize to text at such an odd time of day, but I think if we don't find this deer by noon, we're going to not have any meat. Here's the situation. And you responded right away. We jumped on a call. And some of the questions that you were asking me, like, Jimmy, to your point, were questions that I wouldn't have thought of. But I remember you asking specifically, like, was the deer on edge? Was it alert or was it relaxed? What was the body positioning of the deer? What was the reaction after the hit? A lot of stuff that, you know, I think on the surface, you see as a hunter, you get an arrow or a bullet in something, and you automatically, you're only focused on, okay, where did that animal go? What is the path? But in all reality, you got to be thinking body posture, you know, how it's acting, all that stuff. So one of the things that I think is really interesting is the body positioning at the time of the shot, an alert deer versus a deer that's, you know, pretty relaxed. Can you go into why that matters?
Sure. So a deer that is perhaps within your 15 or 20 yard distance and it's walking and you aren't able to stop that deer, a lot of people will attempt a bleat sound or something just to get a quick halt of that deer. Sometimes, especially during the rut, a buck will maybe not react to that because their mind is elsewhere, or they've been running all night, and so they're mentally tired and sleeping while they're walking.
Yeah.
And so a deer that's is shot with an arrow as it's walking will maybe not get a pass through. That side force on that arrow may well stop that arrow. I've witnessed it personally myself.
Yeah.
But it's a relaxed deer. So as long as that shot is in the boiler room area, it still can be very effective. It's with a practiced round. But a deer that is tense or about to bolt, they're more likely to jump the string.
Yep.
That's a challenge for all deer bow hunters for sure.
And this brings it up another good example. So number two on the list, a good friend of mine, the deer that he shot last year. I'll be curious to look at your notes and see whether that was a one lung or a double lung shot. But I recall that situation as a deer that was inside 20 yards, but he stopped it and it caught his wind, and that deer like immediately was on red dead alert. And here he is at full draw, and it's now or never. You know, release the arrow now or the deer is going to be gone. He shot, hit the deer, but again, this deer is super tense, and it was wheeling and twisting at the impact. And what Eric described to me that you guys talked about, and picture your own skeletal musculature structure as a human. If you're twisted and contorted in a weird angle, and then you go back to relaxed, now wherever your skin position was at the on edge contorted position is now different once you get relaxed.
Sure.
And you described that arrow impacted, and then as soon as the deer moved, the wound cavity was not aligned with the skin. So essentially it was siphoned off, and now we're dealing with only internal bleeding. Even though he's got a 2-inch gash in the side of it, but there's no blood. No external blood. Yep.
That
Can you
deer
go into
is
that?
Just as mortally wounded as it was before. It simply isn't leaving as distinct visual trail for one to track without a dog.
Yeah.
Now it's leaving plenty of body scent. As long as that track remains uncontaminated, it's leaving plenty of tracking scent there for the dog to work with.
Yeah. Hmm. Got it.
And that can happen also when the deer lays down, maybe to relax after a shot, if it doesn't know what caused this incident to happen to them. And they change their body position and they quit bleeding externally, and it starts to coagulate, and then they get up and walk off slowly. It may not leave a exit track there where they left a good trail
to
that bed as well.
So that's why you'll see beds. If a deer beds down multiple times, maybe the first bed has some blood in it, and all of a sudden you'll find a second bed, and there's no blood. Mm-hmm. That deer is still bleeding internally, but it's just been contorted in such a way that it allowed that blood to coagulate, clot up, and now once it has got up and left that bed, it has no external blood.
Huh. Sure. I've had that happen a couple times where you find that either sometimes that first or last bed, and you're like, okay, cool. And, you know, there's coagulated blood in the bed,
yep.
And then it gets up, and it's like, poof.
Vanished.
Like, mm-hmm. Vanished.
Yeah. Yeah. The deer that, ideally, if you're bow hunting, this deer comes into your zone, and you take the shot, and it's a good shot, and the deer doesn't know what happened. It knows that it heard this sound, and it feels strange, and it runs off maybe 200 yards, and if nothing is pursuing it, it starts walking, and then it'll bed up and think about what had occurred there, and they're uncertain still, but they're just not feeling well at that point. That's the ideal deer to track. It will expire with a good hit. It'll expire in that bed, but if the hunter gets too anxious with that, which I understand, I've been in those shoes, and starts tracking that deer too soon and bumps it from that bed, it does a couple of things with that deer. It informs the deer of what caused its pain, and it notifies the deer that it's being pursued. And that is a much, much harder deer to track or recover, because then they go into evasive actions. They're going to take attempts to maybe double back or circle back or use the terrain to their advantage as well. So any deer that's bumped, even once, the recovery goes down with each bump that you make on that deer. Mm-hmm. So that's another reason why the moment you think you might not find this deer, call a dog and at least have that conversation.
Yeah. You know, I mean, you hear it, you know, for years, you know, I mean, when in doubt, back out.
Yep.
You know, and it really does make a lot of sense. And I've done that before. But I've also done it too late.
Yep.
At times, you know, and a part of that goes into what you saw in your mind's eye, and you're like, no, this is good, and you get there, and you're like, yeah, you might have some good blood off the go, and this is, you know, I'm talking after waiting an hour, even 2 hours, because I'm always super conservative.
Yep.
About taking up, you know, even the most confident hit, you know, I could have heard a crash, and I'm like, eh, I'm still gonna wait.
Sure.
You know?
Yep.
But that's super. Super good advice.
Yeah, I mean, just as important as it is to switch, you know, from your field tips to your broadheads and start practicing with your broadheads, it is equal importance to, before the season starts, figure out the trackers in the area that you're going to be hunting. Like right now, you know, I'm planning a North Dakota trip this year. Before I go out there, I'm going to figure out what, if it's determine whether or not it's legal in that state, and if it is, figure out who the trackers are. It's the number you'd hope you don't have, but I'd much rather have that information proactively than go out to North Dakota in an area where I don't have internet or cell service.
Mm-hmm.
Now I have to find this stuff. So that's something that, you know, hindsight, I wish I would have had that information. It all worked out, you know, in my situation, but if I would have had that, your contact info handy right away that night, you know, we probably would have had this discussion a little sooner, and, you know.
Yeah, like you're not planning on it.
Yep.
And would you suggest even going a step further, and, you know, it's good to have that number in your phone, right? Or would you want somebody to make contact with you before the season and say, like, hey, this is who I am. You know, I generally hunt maybe this area. I just want to make that introduction.
It certainly doesn't hurt. And as a handler of a tracking dog, we enjoy those conversations. We love talking about tracking. So it's not a bad idea. Most people won't require a tracker, but when you do, it's usually quite urgent, at least in your mind. We've all made shots where we thought we had done the right thing, and it leads to a sleepless night.
Yep.
No matter how hard you try, you know that deer is out there, and you are involved with that, and you really want to recover that. So I highly recommend at least contacting a tracker and having that conversation. And then if you don't need them, you can contact them in the morning. Let's say you go back and just do a visual search while you have daylight to your advantage again, and you locate the deer. And I had several of those tracks or conversations last year, and I appreciate it, because it also puts that on my schedule, that if I get a call for a track in the opposite direction, remember the commitment that I had made to this conversation,
right,
as opposed to you just initiating that conversation at the moment when I'm happen to be 2 hours further away than I would have normally been. So, mm-hmm, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes,
man,
please.
What the season must be like for you. I mean, you're like an emergency service, basically. It's like...
Yeah, both myself and my dog lose weight during the tracking season, I'm sure. Yeah. Last year was kind of a strange one because here in Wisconsin, we had snow off and on or for several days during the peak rut or pre-rut period.
Yep.
And so there was a lot of hunters out and a lot of deer activity going on and a lot of shots taken just as the snow was falling.
Yep.
And generally you think, well, if it's snowing and I shoot a deer, I don't need a dog because it'll be visual. But that wasn't the case. It snowed on every other night during that pre-rut period. And so it was covering up those tracks. So there were several nights last November, October, then when I would start it after the sun went down and got home well after midnight to do this track and that track.
How does weather affect a track? Like, let's say, you know, like Eric had warm weather conditions. Like, let's say, you know, you shoot a deer in the evening, and I've had this happen before too, and I've actually taken up trails earlier than I wanted to because all of a sudden it starts to rain or it starts to snow, and I'm like, I'm going to visually for myself, how I'm going to track a deer is, you know, with my sight. And now I'm in fear of losing that blood trail. Is that a situation where you're better off backing out, calling the person like you with your dog and saying, I'm going to let you guys sort this out. It doesn't matter if the snow covers the track, the dog can still get on it. Or how does that work?
Sure. Bear in mind again that if you track it too soon for your own reasons and you bump that deer, you're diminishing your own chances of recovering that, but you're also diminishing or reducing the chances that the dog can recover it as well, because that's a different deer to track than one that doesn't know that it's being pursued from a group. So with that in mind, a wet snow isn't generally a problem unless it gets to be, you know, 6-8 inches deep.
Okay.
But a dry, windy snow, that's going to remove that scent at a much greater rate than a wet snow would, or even a heavy dew or a rain. So actually a light rain can enhance the track.
Okay.
If it's been warm and sunny on a hillside and it dries out that track, the blood, whatever the dog is working with, a lot moisture in the air can reestablish that in the air for the dog to work with. So it can actually help.
Okay.
In some of those cases, yeah.
Interesting. It sounds like it almost kind of like reinvigorates all the stuff that the deer's left behind.
For the same reason, if you're a bird hunter, that hunting in the morning, there's the scenting conditions for a dog is much better because there's a lot of dew and moisture in the air.
Interesting. It's
the same reason for blood tracking.
Yeah, I think I've heard, you know, even like lion hunters talk about kind of the same thing, you know?
Sure.
What about, this is one question I've always wondered, does a hit deer or an injured deer smell different, or does it leave different, you know, scent behind than a non-wounded deer?
Okay, thank you. I was going to ask that same question.
Yeah.
Because, there's more than one deer in the woods.
Yep, sure.
Or does each deer just smell different?
Well, they do smell different. They do have their interdigital scent glands, and you've experienced it while in your fall deer stand, you see a buck come up and get across the path where a doe went, and so they can tell sex and age and so forth, just like dogs can do as well with that scent.
It's like leaving a Facebook profile behind you just in the air.
Right. That's insane.
So a wounded deer is stressed, and so it'll leave different scent particles and pheromones and so forth than a healthy deer that might intersect that track and so forth in there as well. Yeah, clearly so.
So you talked about that interdigital scent. What does it look like when you run out of blood? And now, you know, you're what is the dog, how is it processing that? It's just going off that, and I guess, what is it in interdigital scent? Is that a gland that's excreting some kind of scent, or?
Sure. So some of the reasons I was asking the questions about your liver hit deer is sometimes a liver hit deer can react in ways similar to a paunch hit deer.
Yep.
And the wait period for a paunch hit deer is much greater Mm-hmm. And the visual track of a paunch hit deer is much less. A paunch hit deer, if it's an uncontaminated track, is actually a high recovery rate for a dog, but not for a visual tracker. Because
right.
there's very little blood for the reasons we've talked about already, that stomach turns as they move about, and yep. that plugs their entrance / exit wound area. Mm. And so if that scent, if that track is uncontaminated, the dog will very likely recover that deer or locate that deer. But you want to give a paunch hit deer 10, 12 hours.
Got
it's
it.
Not uncommon
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
for those.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
And so you will, with a paunch hit deer, you will have very little visual indication of that track. A couple years ago, we did a track west of here, maybe 60 miles, and that track went a little over 400 yards without any visual indication mm-hmm. of that deer, but the dog was telling me that it was on something active. And finally we got to this blowdown where the deer had taken us through that, and the deer had to jump a log, and the hunter who was behind me at the time came up, and we halted there for a little bit, and we searched that log. We found one drop of blood there to confirm that we were on that track. The only reason there was blood there was because that deer had to stretch to
okay.
overcome that log.
Oh, yeah.
And it was our confirmation, which is something the dog had known all along, that we were on this track. And we went maybe another 60 yards, and it was just over the hill, and it had expired. The deer was there. But, you know, sometimes the confirmation of those is all you need. The dog knows what it's doing.
Yeah,
It just takes experience to read what the dog is dog's body language is telling
yeah.
you.
Yeah.
I mean, man, you know, like, talking about recovering the deer, and one thing that you have in your chart is you have, you know, was the deer found, yes or no, and then was venison recovered, yes
sure.
or no. And so, and Eric, hearing your story about your deer
yep.
and going after it, and all these stories, really, like, I know, for example, like with my wife, sometimes it's like an argument that we'll have on occasion, where if something's left out on the counter, you know, like, I'll go over and give it the sniff test and be like, oh, it's
yeah.
fine. Like, it doesn't smell weird or anything. And then she'll be like, I don't know. It was out. Like, for how long it was out, I feel uncomfortable eating it. I'm like, well, it doesn't smell weird. And it looks fine.
Yeah.
You know? And so then you kind of have, like, different people have different tolerances as to how long something's been out or how funky something gets or whatever, where they're like, yeah, that's okay to eat, or no, that's not okay to eat. And I always wonder to myself, is there, and I know it depends on the conditions, right? So you're late November, basically the deer is walking around in a freezer,
right?
You know, whereas you're August, it's
yeah.
hot and muggy.
Yep.
And so, but you in August waited, I mean, it ended up being a number of hours
yeah.
that it transpired over, and I see a yes next
yep.
to yours with venison recovered.
Yep.
That's interesting. What are you looking for when you're determining whether or not, you know, okay, we finally found this thing. Now the question is, can we salvage this
yeah.
meat? Did you have to trim any weird stuff off the meat that you got off?
Yep.
Or was it all good? Because obviously, like, when the deer's walking around, it's out
right.
in the heat. And its meat stays good when it's just walking around because it has blood pumping through it
yep.
and staying fresh and all that. But
that's a good question. And I remember asking you that same thing, like, right on recovery, like, what are we looking at here for venison? And so what I did in my situation, I remember you saying, like, we got to get it gutted immediately to get this thing cooled off. It was hot. It was September 16th, and it was I think that night it got into the high 60s for
oh,
a low.
Oh, my bad. Did I say August?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay, yeah. Anyway. Either way, in Wisconsin, September's
yeah.
hot too.
Yeah. And then that day, the next day, I mean, it was in the 80s.
Sure.
I think we recovered it around 10 a.m. ish, give or take, 9, 10 a.m. Gutted it immediately. And I remember asking you, you know, what your thoughts were. So you said, yep. And I'm going to get back to that. And I'm going to ask you kind of what you were looking for there. But what I ended up doing then as a next steps is, after getting it gutted, immediately got it into a gas station where I could get a big block of ice, got that in there, and normally I'll process my own deer. This was, we recovered it on a Monday morning. I was up all night and then had to go to work that day. So what I did is I went to a local place here in town and told the processor, I'm like, hey, I just recovered this thing within the half hour. What are we looking at here? He's like, well, let's get it in the walk-in cooler right away And I actually helped them get the hide off it right away. So get that skin off, cool the meat immediately.
Okay.
And when we did that, he looked at it. He gave it a quick once over. He's like, yep, we're good to go. And I've since, you know, eaten the whole deer. And I wouldn't be able to tell a difference between mm-hmm. that and a double lung hit deer that tipped over 50 yards sure. later. So what were you looking for? Yeah. Like once we, you know, when we recovered it, you were really confident right away that mm-hmm. that venison was good. What were you kind of thinking about?
Sure. Well, time and temperature is what I had in mind, and you had plenty of temperature there to work with, but you let's say that you shot that deer at I don't recall, maybe 6 in the evening.
Yeah.
And so for liver hit deer, again, we don't want to bump them, so I'm going to assume that it expired maybe close to midnight.
Yep.
So really that was only 10 hours that it sat under mm-hmm. those conditions, and it was at night. It wasn't in the direct sunlight
and
or,
it was
or the
low
heat.
Too, like in a little creek mm-hmm. bottom too. So
oh my gosh. It's cooler down.
Wow. Yeah. It was perfect.
All things considered, yeah. Yep. Now you might have, to contrast that, you might have a paunch hit deer, which is, let's say it expires 12 hours from the shot time, and you find it 14 hours after the shot.
Yep.
A paunch hit deer is just going to smell, period. But that meat is still good. It takes some fortitude, perhaps, to recover that deer and to clean it out and so forth because of that smell. And we've all been in those shoes, of course, but that meat is still good at that point. It's just that it smells because of where it was hit and so forth.
Got
so
it.
Smell isn't always a strong indicator of the meat
sure.
quality.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is it the point at which it expires that really the clock begins ticking or because I know you hear all kinds of things, right? And like I was saying before, I mean, the reason that a deer's meat doesn't go bad when it's just walking around in the heat is because it's got blood flowing through it. It's alive.
Yep.
And, which, you know, when you first hit it and it kicks up or whatever, it doesn't know what's going on, kind of runs off, walks off, beds down, mm-hmm. and it is approaching its expiration, obviously it's still alive. And so while it's still alive, blood must still be flowing through.
Absolutely.
And, you know, so there's that, which is keeping it alive, which I would think would help sort of keep the meat from immediately upon like impact starting to go bad.
Mm-hmm.
But then you also hear people talk about, you know, the difference in gamey flavor if a deer has, you know, is like super hopped up and it's super, you know, got a bunch of adrenaline
stressed
flowing
out.
Through it. It's really stressed out. People say that meat will taste gamier.
Yep.
Like, Eric, I'm curious, did your meat taste really gamey? Did it taste any different than any other deer? Or, you know, like, how does that all play out?
It didn't in this case, but I don't know that deer ever got super stressed out.
Right.
I am curious, though, what your thoughts are. So, like, on a situation where one has been bumped and it's been pushed and then it's been recovered, you know, after kind of a
rodeo.
Total rodeo, yeah. Mm-hmm. What is, have you ever any experience with that?
Still alive.
Right, exactly.
But it's stressed.
I mean, beyond belief. So do you have any experience in that and what that might
look like? I don't have direct experience in that, but my anecdotal stories would be that meat is going to be more candidate for sausages or something like that. Yeah, it's going to be
a good
tougher meat. There are certain tracking incidences, for instance, a broken leg. Let's say a shot was broke a front leg or back leg bone, major bone on a deer.
Yeah.
If that deer, that's one of the few incidences that you probably don't want to wait. You want to keep that deer active and keep it bleeding.
I've got something
on that. If that deer stops, the bleeding will stop. It'll coagulate in their leg, and they'll leave the area. They won't expire, of course.
Yep.
And that's not a trackable deer
because
it can continue to exceed the dog's capacity to track it.
Okay. Yep. Okay.
A couple of years ago, this was back when I was hunting in Iowa, a state where you can't use recovery dogs.
I think you can now.
You can now, yeah. But for at that time, you could not.
Oh, man, there's a topic.
Yeah, exactly. Definitely. Mm-hmm. And anyways, I shot this buck, which and still to this date was one that, you know, it was the biggest buck I had ever shot. So I really, you know, obviously for all the other reasons, but especially on that, really wanted to find this deer. But I hit it right on the point of the where the leg bone meets the shoulder. If I would have been an inch back, probably would have heart shot the deer. Good height, but it just was right on that joint. Arrow stopped immediately, broke that leg, and what we did is what you just talked about. I mean, immediately we were on that deer, and we pushed it all night long. We pushed them until 7 a.m. the next morning. Yep. And finally, it literally exhausted that deer. I mean, this is just the hard truth of it. Sometimes it doesn't go down as planned, but you still owe your due diligence to the animal. We pushed it to the point where that deer was exhausted. And, I mean, it had gone over a mile and a half at that point and actually glassed it up in its bed. We could see its antlers sticking out of the top of the CRP. The deer was so exhausted at that point that we were able to sneak into bow range, and I was able to get another arrow in it. And that isn't where the story ends. That deer went on and he eventually found it 4 days later. Just ridiculous. But anyway, 5 days later, that was a situation where the meat was not salvageable. But had we not done that, never would have been able to get that second arrow in the deer. Sure. And never would have recovered it.
What did that mid-leg hit look like as far as, like, what kind of blood trail were you guys getting?
Blood was fantastic, and it wasn't mid-leg. It was right where the leg meets the body cavity, but if you picture on a human, your AC joint, where your clavicle meets your shoulder bone.
You picture, like, with a rifle, that's a pretty
good
shot.
Oh, it's a dead
shot.
Deer.
Oh, my
dead
gosh.
Deer, right. Instantaneous. Sure. Yep. Yeah. I mean, it's dropping in its tracks.
Because that's where I hit my Nebraska deer.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Boom, right there.
And the blood looked great. You could tell it was muscle blood. It didn't have any bubbles or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And it was because we kept that deer on its feet, we had blood the entire time. Mm-hmm. We never ran out of blood. And the total length of that track from initial impact to recovery was just under 2.5 miles, 2.3 some miles or whatever.
Wow.
And that was largely in part due to keeping that deer on its feet.
Sure.
A question I've got for you, Tim, is, you know, is there anything that you've seen behavioral-wise on deer that have been shot and, you know, maybe it's been a liver hit, maybe it's been a fatal hit, but it's taken some time. Behavioral-wise, how, like, what do those deer do? Are they going, running off, bedding in an area where they're then watching their back trail? Or
my experience is if they suspect something is coming, they will, and the older and more mature deer will probably do a kind of what it's called a J hook, I guess.
Yep.
They'll come up and then they'll come around generally above so that they have a better view of their back trail. And if you're trying to track them and they're still alive, and they're going to notice you're coming much sooner than you will.
Mm-hmm.
And so they'll just elude themselves back over the top of the hill or out of there before you even get close, and you won't even know, other than perhaps fresh blood if they are still bleeding. But if they've held up on that, you won't recover them that way. Mm-hmm. It's always, clearly, always best to not bump a deer. And also, if you can't avoid it, to not notify the deer that it's being pursued.
Right.
Gotcha.
It's a much higher recovery rate if the deer doesn't suspect that.
That makes sense. Another thing you touched on was, you know, pass-throughs versus not pass-throughs. Is there anything that you've seen that relates to that, that correlates with recovery rates?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. If a deer runs off with the arrow still in it, the chance of recovery is significantly reduced already. There are exceptions to all of that, of course, but I think maybe you had mentioned the deer was shot, it went down, you knew it was yours. Well, that's not always the case, too. Deer can get hit in that anywhere along that backbone or along the neck where it shocks their nervous system, and they just drop like a bag of rocks. But moments later, they get up and they run off. And they run off with a vengeance because that's an informed deer. They don't get up and walk away. They get up and run.
Yeah, you'll see that happen with rifles.
Hit. Yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Now is that deer probably going to expire eventually, and so you're gonna have to wait it out? Or
my experience is that that deer will likely survive at least for a period of time. It may die from infection.
Okay.
Or if it's a neck shot and it got some of their esophagus and so forth, it may die from starvation as a result of infection that takes place in there. But there are trail camera photos of deer that were hit high back that survived well, actually.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's interesting, like you said, and that happens, you know, I think folks go, got them, you know, like they drop like a sack of rocks, right? And I think that's really good to point out. as a hunter, like, don't get overconfident. Stay on that deer, you know, probably with your gun if you can, or because you might end up having to take a follow-up shot. And if you're just high-fiving and looking away, you're going to look back and that deer may not be there. Or you see him running away going, what the heck happened?
Yeah. Like you said, Eric, too, I mean, somebody listening to this as well might be thinking to themselves, if you're relatively new to the sport, you might be thinking like, man, this is all some gruesome stuff that's getting talked about. But, I mean, it kind of is. We even just said right before this podcast, it's like, well, if you leave some stuff like this out, you're just kind of, I mean, you're not really telling the full story.
Yeah, you don't want to sanitize it.
Right. Yeah, well, and when you're calling a blood tracker, it's because things likely didn't go perfect, and that's one of those scenarios.
It will happen. Yeah. If for folks who are new to hunting that might be listening, like, that's one thing that I would say to, you know, it's something that you hope never happens, and in an ideal world it doesn't, but you do have to be prepared for it, and that's where a guy like yourself comes in.
Yeah.
So I didn't answer your question about the interdigital gland and so forth, and I apologize for that, but deer have a gland. They have glands throughout their body that exude scent that the dog works on with training. But their predominant one is a gland between their toes, and it's a waxy substance. And actually, for tracking training, what we handlers will do is use the legs, use the feet, and then we will lay a practice track with their feet. And you freeze the feet, and then you thaw it out, and that wax is laid on the track as you're walking along. And you use very little, sometimes no blood, depending on the training level of the dog. Huh. But not all species have that. I've never tracked elk, but I don't believe elk have interdigital scent glands.
Okay.
So that's a different game itself. They're working on body scent and blood, if there is blood, but other factors that fall from the animal as it passes.
Interesting.
Training these dogs must be just fascinating to watch. I mean, just any time you get to see where you make a bridge between two different species of creature and they're able to communicate and work together is cool. But what you were just talking about there with some of your training regimen a little bit, is that what you did with your dog? What other things were you doing with your dog to get her ready?
Yeah, so with my dog, I started with a very simple liver drag where you tie a piece of venison liver, or it could be any animal liver, and drag it for a short period of time, let the dog focus in on that drag amount, and then you build upon that with time and also less blood, smaller liver, move away from liver, then move to just blood droplets. And then you introduce, this is what I did anyway. Other people might have different ways of training and they're effective as well. But after that blood, then I introduce the feet and lay the blood scent with the feet. And now I use predominantly feet with maybe 3-4 ounces for a 400 to 600 yard track.
Okay.
So it doesn't take very much blood.
Wow.
Gotcha.
And when the dog finds the deer, this is another thing I found interesting. Eric, you were talking about this a little bit, and it's what I've heard when other people talk about it. It's when the dog finds the deer, don't run up to the deer. And I mean, it's essentially when the dog finds it, it's like theirs. That's what they think, right? For a little bit.
There are certain dogs that will take possession of that deer for at least a brief moment, and they'll want to bite it. Each dog has its own way of expressing that, of course. Some of them simply sit down and wait for the handler to come up. But my dog enjoys biting it around the butt area.
Yeah.
I don't know why. But I always attempt at least to ask the hunter, you know, you don't plan to have taxidermy back on this side of the deer. Is it okay if she gets her little reward beforehand? Mm-hmm. But it's important to know. I understand the hunter being excited about finding that deer, but it's important for that hunter to know maybe not to charge in because there may be a possession incident there at that point.
Yep. Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Well, and also, I mean, that dog's put in a lot of work. Like, it deserves a reward.
Yeah.
Yep.
I sometimes will kid some of the hunters when we're on tracks that are 600-800 yards long and we're just taking a break, you know, I tell the hunter that my dog wants to find this deer more than you do as a hunter, because she's dedicated to it. She loves the work, absolutely loves the work.
Yeah. I remember when we got downwind of the deer that you know, that the dog recovered, all of a sudden, like, her demeanor just totally changed. Like, sure. We were kind of, you know, and I actually have, it's really interesting. I saved on Onyx a track of what I did the night before, and I can show you that.
Sure.
And then the next day,
fascinating. Yeah, show me.
Yep, I have the track that we were on with the dog.
Sure.
And it is so interesting to compare that. And you can see all of a sudden when she got downwind of the deer, all of a sudden her persona entirely changed. I remember she started whining. I remember you looked back and you said, "This is good." And it was like 30 seconds later, there we were. We had it recovered.
Sure.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And it was just crazy how that light switched.
At that point, she's like, "I know where it is. I just got to get there."
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Yeah. Let's just get all this other crap out of the
exactly.
way.
Exactly.
I mean, that dovetails perfectly into a question that I wanted to ask. As you're tracking any deer, how is the dog, and maybe it differs between dogs, but how does their demeanor, or how are they telling you what's going on? How are they indicating? Because I've heard that even by the dog's demeanor and how it's acting, the blood tracker will be like, "Guys, this deer's still alive. We're not going to find this deer."
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So what's going on there? What's giving you confidence or maybe not confidence as you're trying to recover this animal?
Sure, sure. That's a good question, and it varies with each dog and dog breed. So it's important for the dog and the handler to get familiar with their own process as well that way. My dog, when she's on a track, her head will be down. She'll be moving her head left and right to try and stay on that track. Dogs and a number of animals, the phrase we use generally is that it smells in stereo, so it can tell if the scent is stronger in its left nostril or its right nostril. So that enables them to decipher if they're going farther from the track or if they're going directly into it and so forth. And so she will work the track with her head moving down, with her head down, and occasionally she'll get scent of something perhaps off to the right, and she'll turn and look and kind of assess the situation and see. Because sometimes, let's say that track has been sitting there overnight and there's been a slight breeze and it moves that scent to a tuft of grass that's off to the side that holds that scent for a greater period of time, even though it's 10 yards off the track, and then the wind takes a different swig and it blows that scent back over her, and she's assessing whether or not that was a blast of scent, but not the scent that is the track that I'm following and so forth. Huh. So
yeah, was that a reliable hit that I just got?
Exactly.
Or not?
Yep. Huh.
Interesting.
Or was that a noise over there, but I don't think it's a noise that's important to what we're doing here today at the moment.
Okay.
And so her body language, the position of her head, the position of her ears, position of her tail, how strong is her desire? My dog wears a harness, and we use here in Wisconsin, the dogs need to be on a leash, which I am in favor of that requirement. Not all states do that. Some of the southern states, they hunt with dogs in a different manner, and they're enabled to by law. But depending on how hard she pulls on the harness and pulls on the track, that's a very strong indication of her ability to stay on that track. Not always is she on the actual track. The track could be over here 5 yards, but the scent has blown off in a certain direction. So, you know, sometimes there may be blood on that track, but we're not seeing it for several hundred yards because we're where the smell or the scent was from that track, not so much where the visual indication was. So the dog is picking up the signals, and her body language is communicating that to me as a handler, but I'm also comparing that with what I'm physically or visually seeing with regard to maybe laid down grass, periodic body fluids, dirt turned up, broken twigs and so
forth.
You're
not just blindly following the dog. You're also looking essentially at the same time.
Right.
And you two work together to...
Yep.
She might get off on one thing and you go, hey, you know, or point over at something else.
Sure.
Checks it out.
Sure. Yep. So I see behind you a roll, and that reminds me also. And
toilet
I don't know
paper
if
roll?
I don't toilet paper roll, right? I don't know. I don't recall if we
had
used that much.
We had to fight somebody for that toilet paper. I'm just kidding.
We had a hat. We ended up putting a hat in a tree on our recovery.
Sure.
But yeah, go into that definitely.
Yeah. So when I get to a hit site with the hunter, I will ask the hunter to follow behind us. and I'll give them a roll of toilet paper.
Yep.
And our goal is such that I will ask them to hang about eyesight, just a piece, a sheet of toilet paper, whenever we see physical sign that, mm-hmm. of confirmation that we're on the track.
Oh, right, yeah.
And that does a couple of things, but they stay behind me, and if I see blood and haven't seen it for 10 yards or so, I'll tell them that there's blood here, come and hang something here. And so we can then, once we get 100 yards down a trail or a track, we can look back and see where that deer has been going, and has it been going straight or has it turned? It kind of gives us an idea of what to assess, perhaps if we lose that visual signal, or if the dog indicates that we're no longer on that track. It gives us a flag to circle back and come back on and maybe reset and pick up the trail again, which can be important. So when you're tracking with a dog, you want to, if you know that the blood is here, you want to walk off to the side. You want to make sure you don't disturb that track, visual track, and also the scent track. So walk preferably on the downwind side.
Okay.
Yep.
And try and avoid stepping into that track.
Okay, because if you're upwind of it,
scent would be blowing over the track.
Okay, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Which can be difficult at
it
times
is.
Because the deer is most likely on the trail or a trail. And I know even when I've been tracking without a dog, I try to not disturb that sign in case I need to go back to it. But sometimes it's just difficult. Like there could be briars to the right and left or thick brush or things like that. So, but I think it's definitely important to whether you're with a, you know, using a tracking dog or not. I mean, you brought up a couple things that when I've been on some difficult blood trails, flagging that blood trail out just so you have that visual indicator, you can figure out, like you said, oh, is the deer, you know, meandering or is it on a pretty straight vector to where if you maybe you do lose blood for X amount of yards, you know, probably at this point you should have called Tim. But you can take that vector and go, well, I'm going to continue down this path and hopefully, you know, pick it back up again. And Eric, you brought up another really good point. And nowadays I do both, but start your tracker.
Yep.
You know, start your tracker on your Onyx. You know, that's going to help you. And then I'm sure that could help you, Tim. Also, Eric can go, this is Eric or whoever, right?
Yeah.
This is where we've been. This is what we did. So then you can, you know, you're not like going off of, well, we went over here and then we kind of did this. You can kind of look at that and go, okay, I can see pretty much exactly where you guys went. And I guess, you know, adjust accordingly, or at least you have the background of like what that track or how difficult it's going
to
be.
Yep. Or for night tracking, it's especially important because I have to get back to the vehicle after the track is done.
Yeah.
And sometimes I could be, like you say, a mile away
and
not know because it all looks different. But I do use that Onyx tracking to also monitor how far the track is on here. So I record that as well.
Yep.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Is your dog a really good truck tracker too? sometimes I feel like I could have used something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where am I?
Yes.
They know things that we don't, certainly. I'm well aware of grouse hunters that have encountered wolf pack and their dog disappears and then they get back to the vehicle and the dog is waiting for them. So
really? Wow.
I haven't experienced that myself, but I'm well aware that the dog knows more than I do about location.
It is amazing.
You ever run into like any spooky stuff where you're just like all of a sudden the dog does something and you're like, man, I get an eerie feeling about.
Yeah, so there are some dogs that will react to coyotes, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
If the coyote gets to the deer before you did, their body language will sometimes indicate. So they'll react differently, but they'll maybe mark a little bit more and they'll be a little more cautious. And then you realize that there's coyote or dog scent here. I don't track in an area where there are wolves, but perhaps they would run into something like that as well.
Yeah.
And there are trackers that do bear tracking and hog tracking and elk and antelope and so forth too. So
interesting. Has there been anything that you've taken away from your experience with, you know, recoveries and whatnot that it would dictate your equipment choices on like arrows or anything? Like, and obviously not to name specific brands, but is there a certain style of setup that you would lean towards over another?
I know there's as many people in support as opposed
yep,
to
exactly.
certain sets of equipment, but my experience is mechanical broadheads, when they perform, they are absolutely, they yeah. perform beautifully,
yeah.
but when they fail miserably, mm-hmm. and most of those miserably failures are ones where the deer is at a steeper angle,
yep.
and it doesn't hit directly perpendicular to the body, and
yep.
and the reaction of the blades is different, and there's more skimming going on
yep.
and so forth. So I would say that. But you know what? This couple of the last two tracks I did last year were gun season
yeah.
tracks, and mm-hmm. there should be no reason for them. One was a 6.5 Creedmoor, and I don't recall what the other one was, but
oh, man.
It can happen with guns as well.
Yeah.
And both of those shots were believed to be fatal and mortal shots at the time. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, stuff happens sometimes. You can't anticipate that.
Do you recall where, when you recovered the deer, where they were hit?
The Creedmoor, you're speaking of the firearm
yeah.
one?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So the Creedmoor deer, yep. perhaps you could
yeah,
read it
so
there.
Yeah, so it says, coring away steep angle into one lung and out. On the far opposite shoulder, heavy lung blood on the track, deer bedded at 400 yards. We bumped the deer from the bed, clear sign of entry and exit wound on this deer, but still alive and still capable of running 6 hours after the shot.
Incredible.
As yeah. you describe that,
yep.
I would 100% say that's a dead deer within seconds.
Agreed.
Yeah.
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 Agreed. Yeah, I was expecting more of like a hit in back leg or, you know, what, here, something.
The very next one is also an interesting one. One lung and exit on the stomach, 308 at 80 yards. Deer was bumped from the bed twice by hunters 2 hours after the shot and was pushed over about 900 yards. Went in with the dog, 24-hour-old track, and deer was located in a near creek that died the night before. So that approximate track length was over a mile.
Wow.
80 yards with 308.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
That is the one thing that I think I've taken away from my experience, too, and I'm curious what your thoughts are, but one lung hits are just so variable.
Yes, they are. They're highly variable, yeah. And they're oftentimes one where you would swear that deer is going to be just around the corner, because
yeah.
there's generally some pretty good sign.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of reasons to be confident that deer is in your pocket.
Yeah.
And so it's terribly disappointing when you're unable to recover those,
yeah.
for sure.
Mm-hmm. A neighbor that I used to hunt next to shot a deer that I had photos of on November 1st, one lung hit, arrow actually passed through the deer. Fascinating. Arrow passed through, one lung hit, steep quartering, two angle, and blood. You would look at that blood trail and say, this is a dead deer. I'm going to find him 80 yards.
Well, particularly, maybe not right away, but one lung, quartering two, pass through. I mean, I visually look at that and I go, well, he got one lung, guts, maybe liver.
Like that deer was hit on November 1st. I killed it with a muzzleloader on January 2nd. And I'm convinced that deer would
sure.
have lived. When I
yep.
gutted the deer, the lung that was hit looked like a raisin, like you've seen the smoker's lung advertisements.
Sure.
yep. That's what it looked like. And, I mean, the deer, I have photos of the deer the day that I shot him. He was plump and big, you know, big-bodied deer,
yep.
old buck, and crazy.
Just a savage of a deer. That's
yep.
the deer that you don't mess with at the bar.
Yeah,
like,
that deer
was acting.
He's got
totally
some
normal
stories.
I have photos of him in a food plot that I hunted that year. That I think a week or 2 weeks after the shot, he's chasing does in this food plot, broad daylight, unbelievable exit wound on the front side, and he's just sitting there like the world is
taking care of business. Yeah,
yep.
Does dig scars.
They do. They do.
Yeah, and the other thing about the lung area is that, you know, the lung is almost triangular shape, perhaps, but
yep.
that top tail is less important to their survival than a lung hit down in the body. So if you one lung them up in that area, the survival rate is greater. It's less effective to their ability to survive.
So like the more higher and rearward, the less
vital it is.
The less
yeah.
vital. Okay.
Higher and further back, the less vital it is.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. That is very interesting.
As opposed to hitting them center in the lungs where all the work is done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
But then again, also, you know, if you have a steep angle, you may hit the liver in there, and that changes the game as well, because that's tucked up back.
Yep. Exactly.
In that area.
Well, your arrow, and maybe, I mean, might be difficult to tell, but like, let's say you ended up, you know, maybe the deer spun a little bit or it was slightly quartering too. Maybe you get one lung and liver. Will the arrow itself, if you recover it, will the blood on the arrow look like liver blood or lung blood or both?
Yeah.
Like, will the liver kind of wipe off that lung blood?
Not necessarily. It depends on what else the arrow passes through. Sometimes the arrow can tell you a great deal about what time you should wait. Mm-hmm. And what the arrow had passed through and how much fat is on there. Maybe the fletching caught some fat, and that's an indication. The color of and length of the hair at the hit site is a pretty strong indication of hit area as well, if it's assessed properly as well. Yeah, and then for those that are maybe questionable hits, smell the arrow. Does it smell like paunch material and so forth as well?
Sure. Yeah, I did want to circle back to the paunch hit topic, or paunch, I mean, commonly referred to as a gut shot. So the paunch is, you know, kind of, I guess, the stomach area of the deer. And, you know, I guess speaking to, you know, predominantly bow hunting, but rifle hunting too, but you hit a deer in the paunch or the guts, and as a hunter, your heart sinks. You're like, this is not good. To what you pointed out earlier, Tim, probably not going to have a lot of visual sign, not a lot of blood to go off of. At least, you know, I've done it a couple times, and that was my experience.
Sure.
The deer is going to take, you know, longer to expire. You said how many hours in general?
I would recommend 12 hours wait before you even start the track. And again, under the premise that you want to track a deer that's expired, I would say give them 12 hours if you can. Now, I understand there are circumstances where you can't. Maybe coyotes, maybe trespass authority only during night or so on and so forth. But our preference is to wait, yes.
But so I look a situation like that, which I've been in, unfortunately, and not recovered the deer, you know, and we're talking about maybe what to look for. That's generally a pretty easy one to tell what happened if you're able to recover your arrow, which I'd say is kind of a softer spot of the animal. So the chance of a pass-through probably is... You know,
greater.
Pretty good, yeah, greater. What's a person going to find on that arrow, Tim, that's going to lead them to believe, like, yep, this is a paunch hit?
So there'll be probably very little blood, or it'll be a wet, oily blood, green stomach material. It'll smell. It'll
like
smell like...
plant matter?
No, like stomach.
Or, I guess, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, old plant matter. Former plant matter.
Former former plant matter, almost kind of like granular?
You might find some food particles there. You might say, depending on where it's hit, you might find some chewed up grass or corn and so forth. But it'll have a smell to it for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I usually try to not only see the arrow before we start a track, but I also let the dog inspect it.
Okay.
So that she can kind of hone in on what type of scent we might be
looking
for as well.
I'm sure she's getting some real good stuff there.
Sure.
I mean,
meaningful information
stuff
to them.
The inside, yeah.
So, and I guess the one thing, and we definitely hit on this earlier, but I think, you know, that's definitely a situation where if you're not using a dog, I'd say your odds of recovery are
slim.
Like, not great. I mean, you can do it. It definitely happens, right? But it's just, to me, it's like, whoa, I've got the situation where maybe before, like, not a lost cause, but not, you know, confidence level not high.
Yeah.
But if I can recognize that off the go as that's what's happened, and I leave that track alone and call a blood tracker, you were saying there's a pretty darn high level of recovery. So, like, not the ideal situation, not what you want. You don't want that animal to suffer or expire hours later. But if you do get in that scenario... leave it alone and call a person like you.
Yep, call in a dog and a handler. And if you happen to get to that, the deer, a paunch hit deer, would prefer not to be disturbed. And so you may come upon that deer and it's still alive but unhappy. Mm-hmm. And in Wisconsin, you can't carry a weapon when you're doing dog tracking. So what you would have to do then is get the handler and the dog out of that environment and the hunter go back in and and do some finish up work there.
Mm-hmm. Man, there's some legal stuff that makes for more interesting topics.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The last question I got for you, Tim, is, you know, I'm just kind of going through your list here, and there is one point where you made, you noted 35-yard shot without a lighted knock. This is something that I have really, really strong feelings for in favor of lighted knocks. And I think we're kind of on the same wavelength there, but could you go into the benefits of lighted knocks and know why or why you maybe wouldn't if you don't recommend, but why you would recommend that?
Sure. Yeah, there's a lot more crossbow hunting going on for sure, and crossbows are their arrow or bolt is much, much faster than an arrow. But also some of the premium shooting time is early light or late light. Mm-hmm. And part of the reaction, watching for the reaction of the deer, is also knowing where you believe your arrow struck the deer. Mm-hmm. And without a lighted knock, some of those arrows are just so fast that you can't tell.
Yep.
And so my recommendation by far is to use lighted knocks whenever you can, and to test them, because you know, for economy reasons, we're using the arrow lighted knocks from last year, and maybe the battery's not quite so strong anymore.
Also, the reason being primarily to be able to see the arrow in flight and where it approximately hits.
Where it struck.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's
not being big into archery, I always just thought it was so that you could find your arrow.
Right. Well, that is part of it as well.
I mean, I figured it was probably part of it.
That was actually how I found my arrow the night that I hit that deer. Lighted knock, the arrow buried into an alfalfa field of alfalfa that was 8 inches tall. So I waited till it got pitch black, and then I just walking in and I could see a glow in the grass. I'm like, there's my arrow. But anyways.
Or an alien.
Which gave you a lot of information to go off of.
Good information, yep. But anyways, I, you know, spent 5 years editing hunting videos, and videos that didn't use a lighted knock, it was, even going frame by frame, hard to tell where the arrow impacted the animal.
Mm-hmm. And if you don't get a pass through and that deer runs off, it's much easier to tell that arrow is still in the deer by the lighted knock as it goes through the
horse. It's not just a matter of, well, I can't find the arrow, so maybe it's just lost, or maybe it's in the deer. It's like, no, I don't see a light.
Yeah, in my opinion, where it's legal, the pros far outweigh the cons of using a lighted knock.
Mm-hmm.
So,
like you said, you get into some of the laws.
I know,
some
it
of
makes
for
a really interesting conversation even further, but we're already,
I want to briefly just touch on trespass authority as well, because that can be a major part of tracking. So if you think, as a hunter, if you think the deer possibly went in a direction that goes on neighboring property, while you're waiting for the dog to get there, please make an effort to get tracking authority on neighboring property. You may not need to do it, but if we as a handler get to that property line, we have to stop. We have to call it. We can tell you what we believe that deer is and what the chances of recovery is, but we won't.
Right.
We won't go over there.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's a great point.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and like you said, that's some legwork that, you know, the person who hit the deer can hopefully try and do on the front end expedite the process.
Right. Yep.
Will the dog indicate if the deer is like still on its feet and alive? Is that easy to tell or not easy to tell?
It is with some dogs more so than others. My dog, when she's tracking a deer that is still alive, her body communication will change. Her head will come up. I think she voiced on our track, Eric, when she wanted to go in that direction. So she'll do more of that. She'll rear up on her hind legs and pull on the harness and want to get that deer. So, most, at least my dog will indicate, and I believe most of them will as well.
Okay. Yeah.
Some of them may voice it as well, start barking or whining and so forth.
Yep. Yeah. I would equate it to like just having hunted over like labs, you know, for pheasants and stuff or for grouse, like, right before all of a sudden you end up flushing something, I think every dog is going to act a little different. And it's just, like you said, you know your dog's body language. Mm-hmm. And I think that handler is going to know that because you're spending so much time. Mm-hmm. I mean, just on this list here, you got 42 tracks, you know?
I mean,
so you'll
each one
pick
of these
up habits.
Notes that you have next to each track, like they're all fascinating in their own way.
Absolutely. Yep. I mean, finding them in rivers or, you know, finding them in just very interesting places or how far they went. And
I mean, the data there is like, you know, as a hunter, you only get like so many chances to have these various experiences, and you have experienced probably, you know, they're all unique, but I mean, the amount.
They are unique. And with a dog handler, we don't get called on, we rarely get called on the easy one. So it's already a challenge before a dog generally gets pulled in there. You mentioned the one in the river, which that track was interesting in that it was in the track was in the rain.
Yeah.
It was raining conditions. Mm-hmm. And that my dog took me to that river three times. And we, myself and the hunter, kind of assessed what this might mean because we couldn't see the deer and there was really no blood to see at that.
Because it was
she
raining
kept circling
hard.
Around. And at that point, the river is several hundred yards wide, and we thought maybe the deer attempted to swim and got caught in the current, and it's vanished. Finally, the third time we went to that, she took us to the river. We were up river a little bit, and I happened to glance off to the side, and there the deer was under the water beneath a major tree branch. So fortunately, it wasn't out in the current, and it was, I think there was an antler and maybe the tail was sticking out or something like that. So
unreal.
It's just by chance that I happened to look then. Of course, the dog knew it all the time, and she was wondering what the heck we were out there for a walk three times for.
But crazy.
She still won't forgive me for that
one. You can keep taking me away from it. I'm just going to keep showing you where it is.
Yeah,
right. That actually, so I feel like I have a million questions. I know I have one more, because one thing that I've heard since I was a kid, you hit a deer, if you're having a hard time finding it, you know, it's going to go towards water. So, if, you know, maybe go find where's the nearest water source, and that's a good spot to look. How much truth is there to that? Like, are you finding a lot of these deer that have been hit and are, you know, like a paunch hit deer or something like that? Are you finding them close to water?
Yeah, my personal experience is not necessarily, there's as many exceptions as there is to the rule.
Okay.
That's my personal experience. But I continue to read that paunch hit deer especially get thirsty. And I know of people that have suffered significant wounds and they lose blood, and they say that it's surprising how thirsty you get when you lose blood. But that's all I have to base it on. I can tell you that there's as many exceptions in tracking as there are rules to that about deer going to water or going downhill or not going uphill. I didn't find that to be the case.
Okay. That's good to know.
You heard it here.
I know personally I'm going to read through each and every one of these.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly what I'm doing right now.
Tim, we've had you on, I mean, for like almost an hour and a half here, and it's just there's so much more we could talk about.
Yep.
But we won't eat up all your time, and also listeners, you might have had by the end of this podcast, now you might have commuted to work and back the entire week. Who knows?
Yep.
I don't know. but yeah, this has been awesome, so thank you a ton for joining us on here. But yeah, any last calls, though, as we sign off?
I do want to just give a shout out to the hunters that do things right and call in a tracking dog as opposed to doing all things wrong and trying to get back out there and then calling a tracking dog. And my experience is the more times a hunter calls, the more likely they are going back out there and searching before they call again. And by then the track is what I would call contaminated. So I want to applaud those that do things the proper way and increase their chances of recovery.
Yep.
But I also want to thank you guys for the opportunity to share some of these ideas and
absolutely.
These stories.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Thank you.
Yep. I think it's incredibly beneficial for listeners to get that info prior to hunting season. So this is really good stuff. Mm-hmm.
For sure. Hope everybody out there listening, though, has a great fall season or whatever season that you're going into. And as Tim has mentioned, if you find yourself in the situation, you got to exercise some patience. You got to exercise a little bit of forethought and stuff like that.
Yep.
But yeah, consider if things don't go exactly according to plan, checking this stuff out. So, yeah.
Cool.
Thanks again.
Thanks, Tim.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll catch you next time. Bye.
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 All right, that'll wrap it up for this episode of the Vortex Nation podcast. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Hit that subscribe button so you can always stay up to date on the latest happenings over here at the Vortex Nation podcast. Leave us a review or comment down below. We want to hear what you have to say about the show, maybe what you like, maybe what you didn't like, so that way we can make these podcasts as good as they can be. You can also follow us on Instagram at Vortex Nation Podcast. We'll be posting about each episode released, so that way you can go back, find these things, maybe grab a little nugget of information that you can take with you to the range, out in the field, or maybe to the kitchen if we're talking about some good food. So, again, everybody, thanks, and happy hunting and shooting. We appreciate it. Have a good one.